Chapter 136. Containing the story of the bagman's uncle, my uncle, gentleman, apostrophe said the bagman, was one of the merriest, pleasantest, cleverest fellows that ever lived. I wish you had known him, gentlemen. On second thoughts, gentlemen, I don't wish you had known him, for if you had, you would have been all, by this time, in the ordinary course of nature, if not dead, at all events so near it, as to have taken to stopping at home and giving up company, which would have deprived me of the inestimable pleasure of addressing you at this moment. Gentlemen, I wish your fathers and mothers had known my uncle. They would have been amazingly fond of him, especially your respectable mothers. I know they would. If any two of his numerous virtues predominated over the many that adorned his character, I should say they were his mixed punch, and his after-supper song. Excuse my dwelling on these melancholy recollections of departed worth. You won't see a man like my uncle every day in the week. I have always considered it a great point in my uncle's character, gentlemen, that he was the intimate friend and companion of Tom Smart, of the great house of Bilson and Slum, Cadiaton Street, City. My uncle collected for Tiggin and Welps, but for a long time he went pretty near the same journey as Tom, and the very first night they met, my uncle took a fancy for Tom, and Tom took a fancy for my uncle. They made a bet of a new hat, before they had known each other half an hour, who should brew the best quart of punch, and drink it the quickest. My uncle was judged to have won the making, but Tom Smart beat him in the drinking by about half a salt spoonful. They took another quart apiece to drink each other's health in, and were staunch friends ever afterwards. There's a destiny in these things, gentlemen. We can't help it. In personal appearance, my uncle was a trifle shorter than the middle size. He was a thought stouter too, than the ordinary run of people, and perhaps his face might be a shade redder. He had the jolliest face you ever saw, gentlemen. Something like Punch, with a handsome nose and chin. His eyes were always twinkling and sparkling with good humor, and a smile not one of your unmeaning wooden grins, but a real, merry, hearty, good-tempered smile was perpetually on his countenance. He was pitched out of his gig once, and knocked, head first, against a milestone. There he lay, stunned, and so cut about the face with some gravel which had been heaped up alongside it, that, to use my uncle's own strong expression, if his mother could have revisited the earth, she wouldn't have known him. Indeed, when I come to think of the matter, gentlemen, I feel pretty sure she wouldn't. For she died when my uncle was 2 years and 7 months old, and I think it's very likely that, even without the gravel, his top boots would have puzzled the good lady not a little, to say nothing of his jolly red face. However, there he lay, and I have heard my uncle say, many a time, that the man said who picked him up, that he was smiling as merrily as if he had tumbled out for a treat, and that after they had bled him, the first faint glimmerings of returning animation, were his jumping up in bed, bursting out into a loud laugh, kissing the young woman who held the basin, and demanding a mutton chop and a pickled walnut. He was very fond of pickled walnuts, gentlemen. He said he always found that, taken without vinegar, they relished the beer. My uncle's great journey was in the fall of the leaf, at which time he collected debts, and took orders, in the north, going from London to Edinburgh, from Edinburgh to Glasgow, from Glasgow back to Edinburgh, and thence to London by the smack. You are to understand, that his second visit to Edinburgh, was for his own pleasure. He used to go back for a week, just to look up his old friends, and what with breakfasting with this one, lunching with that, dining with the third, and supping with another, a pretty tight week he used to make of it. I don't know whether any of you, gentlemen, ever partook of a real substantial hospitable Scotch breakfast, and then went out to a slight lunch of a bushel of oysters, a dozen or so of bottled ale, and a noggin or two of whiskey to close up with. If you ever did, you will agree with me that it requires a pretty strong head to go out to dinner and supper afterwards. But bless your hearts and eyebrows, all this sort of thing was nothing to my uncle. He was so well seasoned that it was mere child's play. I have heard him say that he could see the Dundee people out any day and walk home afterwards without staggering, and yet the Dundee people have as strong heads and as strong punch, gentlemen, as you are likely to meet with between the poles. I have heard of a Glasgow man and a Dundee man drinking against each other for 15 hours at a sitting. They were both suffocated, as nearly as could be ascertained, at the same moment, but with this trifling exception, gentlemen, they were not a bit the worse for it. One night, within 24 hours of the time, when he had settled to take shipping for London, my uncle supped at the house of a very old friend of his, a Bailey Mac something and four syllables after it, who lived in the old town of Edinburgh. There were the Bailey's wife, and the Bailey's three daughters, and the Bailey's grown-up son, and three or four stout, bushy-eyebrowed, canny, old Scotch fellows that the Bailey had got together to do honor to my uncle and help to make merry. It was a glorious supper. There was kippered salmon, and finnan haddocks, and a lamb's head, and a haggis, a celebrated Scotch dish, gentlemen, which my uncle used to say always looked to him, when it came to table, very much like a Cupid's stomach, and a great many other things besides, that I forget the names of, but very good things, notwithstanding. The lassies were pretty and agreeable. The Bailey's wife was one of the best creatures that ever lived, and my uncle was in thoroughly good cue. The consequence of which was, that the young ladies tittered and giggled, and the old lady laughed out loud, and the Bailey and the other old fellows roared till they were red in the face, the whole mortal time. I don't quite recollect how many tumblers of whiskey toddy each man drank after supper, but this I know, that about 1 o'clock in the morning, the Bailey's grown-up son became insensible while attempting the first verse of Willie Brewed a Peck o' Malt, and he having been, for half an hour before, the only other man visible above the mahogany, it occurred to my uncle that it was almost time to think about going, especially as drinking had set in at 7 o'clock, in order that he might get home at a decent hour. But, thinking it might not be quite polite to go just then, my uncle voted himself into the chair, mixed another glass, rose to propose his own health, addressed himself in a neat and complimentary speech, and drank the toast with great enthusiasm. Still nobody woke, so my uncle took a little drop more neat this time, to prevent the toddy from disagreeing with him, and, laying violent hands on his hat, sallied forth into the street. It was a wild, gusty night when my uncle closed the Bailey's door, and settling his hat firmly on his head, to prevent the wind from taking it, thrust his hands into his pockets, and looking upward, took a short survey of the state of the weather. The clouds were drifting over the moon at their giddiest speed, at one time wholly obscuring her, at another, suffering her to burst forth in full splendor, and shed her light on all the objects around, anon, driving over her again, with increased velocity, and shrouding everything in darkness. "Really, this won't do," said my uncle, addressing himself to the weather, as if he felt himself personally offended. "This is not at all the kind of thing for my voyage." "It will not do at any price," said my uncle, very impressively. Having repeated this several times, he recovered his balance with some difficulty, for he was rather giddy with looking up into the sky so long, and walked merrily on. The Bailey's house was in the Canongate, and my uncle was going to the other end of Leith Walk, rather better than a mile's journey. On either side of him, there shot up against the dark sky, tall, gaunt, straggling houses, with time-stained fronts, and windows that seemed to have shared the lot of eyes in mortals, and to have grown dim and sunken with age. 6, 7, 8 story high were the houses, story piled upon story, as children build with carts throwing their dark shadows over the roughly paved road, and making the dark night darker. A few oil lamps were scattered at long distances, but they only served to mark the dirty entrance to some narrow close, or to show where a common stair communicated, by steep and intricate windings, with the various flats above. Glancing at all these things with the air of a man who had seen them too often before, to think them worthy of much notice now, my uncle walked up the middle of the street, with a thumb in each waistcoat pocket, indulging from time to time in various snatches of song, chanted forth with such goodwill and spirit, that the quiet honest folk started from their first sleep, and lay trembling in bed till the sound died away in the distance. When, satisfying themselves that it was only some drunken ne'er-do-weel finding his way home, they covered themselves up warm, and fell asleep again. I am particular in describing how my uncle walked up the middle of the street, with his thumbs in his waistcoat pockets, gentlemen, because, as he often used to say, and with great reason too, there is nothing at all extraordinary in this story, unless you distinctly understand at the beginning, that he was not by any means of a marvelous or romantic turn. Gentlemen, my uncle walked on with his thumbs in his waistcoat pockets, taking the middle of the street to himself, and singing, now a verse of a love song, and then a verse of a drinking one, and when he was tired of both, whistling melodiously, until he reached the North Bridge, which, at this point, connects the old and new towns of Edinburgh. Here he stopped for a minute, to look at the strange irregular clusters of lights piled one above the other, and twinkling afar off so high, that they looked like stars, gleaming from the castle walls on the one side, and the Calton Hill on the other, as if they illuminated veritable castles in the air, while the old picturesque town slept heavily on, in gloom and darkness below. Its palace and chapel of Holyrood, guarded day and night, as a friend of my uncle's used to say, by old Arthur's Seat, towering, surly and dark, like some gruff genius, over the ancient city he has watched so long. I say, gentlemen, my uncle stopped here, for a minute, to look about him, and then, paying a compliment to the weather, which had a little cleared up, though the moon was sinking, walked on again, as royally as before, keeping the middle of the road with great dignity, and looking as if he would very much like to meet with somebody who would dispute possession of it with him. There was nobody at all disposed to contest the point, as it happened. And so, on he went, with his thumbs in his waistcoat pockets, like a lamb. When my uncle reached the end of Leith Walk, he had to cross a pretty large piece of waste ground which separated him from a short street which he had to turn down to go direct to his lodging. Now, in this piece of waste ground, there was, at that time, an enclosure belonging to some wheelwright who contracted with the post office for the purchase of old, worn-out mail coaches. And my uncle, being very fond of coaches, old, young, or middle-aged, all at once took it into his head to step out of his road for no other purpose than to peep between the palings at these mails about a dozen, of which he remembered to have seen, crowded together in a very forlorn and dismantled state, inside. My uncle was a very enthusiastic, emphatic sort of person, gentlemen. So, finding that he could not obtain a good peep between the palings, he got over them, and sitting himself quietly down on an old axle tree, began to contemplate the mail coaches with a deal of gravity. There might be a dozen of them, or there might be more. My uncle was never quite certain on this point, and being a man of very scrupulous veracity about numbers, didn't like to say, but there they stood, all huddled together in the most desolate condition imaginable. The doors had been torn from their hinges and removed. The linings had been stripped off, only a shred hanging here and there by a rusty nail. The lamps were gone, the poles had long since vanished, the ironwork was rusty, the paint was worn away, the wind whistled through the chinks in the bare woodwork, and the rain, which had collected on the roofs, fell, drop by drop, into the insides with a hollow and melancholy sound. They were the decaying skeletons of departed males, and in that lonely place, at that time of night, they looked chill and dismal. My uncle rested his head upon his hands, and thought of the busy, bustling people who had rattled about, years before, in the old coaches, and were now as silent and changed. He thought of the numbers of people to whom one of these crazy, moldering vehicles had borne, night after night, for many years, and through all weathers, the anxiously expected intelligence, the eagerly looked for remittance, the promised assurance of health and safety, the sudden announcement of sickness and death. The merchant, the lover, the wife, the widow, the mother, the schoolboy, the very child who tottered to the door at the postman's knock, how had they all looked forward to the arrival of the old coach? And where were they all now? Gentlemen, my uncle used to say that he thought all this at the time, but I rather suspect he learned it out of some book afterwards, for he distinctly stated that he fell into a kind of doze as he sat on the old axle tree looking at the decayed mail coaches, and that he was suddenly awakened by some deep church bell striking two. Now, my uncle was never a fast thinker, and if he had thought all these things, I am quite certain it would have taken him till full half past 2 o'clock at the very least. I am, therefore, decidedly of opinion, gentlemen, that my uncle fell into a kind of doze, without having thought about anything at all. Be this as it may, a church bell struck two. My uncle woke, rubbed his eyes, and jumped up in astonishment. In one instant, after the clock struck two, the whole of this deserted and quiet spot had become a scene of most extraordinary life and animation. The mail coach doors were on their hinges, the lining was replaced, the ironwork was as good as new, the paint was restored, the lamps were alight, cushions and greatcoats were on every coach box. Porters were thrusting parcels into every boot, guards were stowing away letter bags, hostlers were dashing pails of water against the renovated wheels, numbers of men were pushing about, fixing poles into every coach, passengers arrived, portmanteaus were handed up, horses were put to. In short, it was perfectly clear that every mail there was to be off directly. Gentlemen, my uncle opened his eyes so wide at all this, that, to the very last moment of his life, he used to wonder how it fell out that he had ever been able to shut them again. "Now then," said a voice, as my uncle felt a hand on his shoulder, "you're booked for one inside. You'd better get in." "I booked," said my uncle, turning round. "Yes, certainly." My uncle, gentlemen, could say nothing, he was so very much astonished. The queerest thing of all was that, although there was such a crowd of persons, and although fresh faces were pouring in, every moment, there was no telling where they came from. They seemed to start up, in some strange manner, from the ground, or the air, and disappear in the same way. When the porter had put his luggage in the coach, and received his fare, he turned round and was gone. And before my uncle had well begun to wonder what had become of him, half a dozen fresh ones started up, and staggered along under the weight of parcels, which seemed big enough to crush them. The passengers were all dressed so oddly too. Large, broad-skirted lace coats, with great cuffs and no collars, and wigs, gentlemen, great formal wigs with a tie behind. My uncle could make nothing of it. "Now, are you going to get in?" said the person who had addressed my uncle before. He was dressed as a mail guard, with a wig on his head, and most enormous cuffs to his coat, and had a lantern in one hand, and a huge blunderbuss in the other, which he was going to stow away in his little arm chest. "Are you going to get in, Jack Martin?" said the guard, holding the lantern to my uncle's face. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.